Welcome to this episode of Coffee Chats with Researchers. I am Katie Butner, and today you're going to hear my conversation with Dr. Rachel Vostrog, who is a professor at the University of Texas, and she describes her work in detail, and we have a really rich conversation about how her experiences in a really diverse set of community organizations have led her to where she's at now, which, if you've been listening to these for a while, you will realize is a pretty salient undertone to a lot of folks' experiences. But she currently does a lot around understanding and evaluating survivor-centered services, so those voluntary programs, and how we're ensuring that they're connected to what the community, and that community being survivors of violence, like what they're really needing and what they're asking for. So it's a really great conversation. She is a generous and kind and incredibly intelligent human to speak to. So enjoy this conversation, and I will see you for the next episode.
So my name is Rachel Vostrog. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Texas at Arlington School of Social Work. Before going back to school and doing my PhD, which I did at the Brown School at Washington University, I worked in domestic violence intervention and prevention work. So I had the real privilege and honor to work at Redevelopment Opportunities for Women, which is an agency in St. Louis, Missouri, that was one of the real sort of initial piloting sites for economic justice work. We did individual development. They still do. When I was there, I did work around individual development accounts on economic education and economic advocacy, and really recognizing the central role of economic stability and self-sufficiency and safety, particularly with survivors. And so that experience, as well as previous work that I've done in child mental health and in that area of safety, really contributed to my thinking about working with survivors, my love for the work of domestic violence service providers and advocates. Advocates are my favorite people in the world. And so anytime I get to do projects that work with, anytime I get to do projects, I figure out a way to work with them. And, you know, so many of my favorite researchers, similarly, are former advocates. And, you know, that's something that I have in common with so many of the people whose work I respect and try to emulate and love the opportunity to bump up against and work with when possible. So that's sort of how I got to where I'm at now. At this point, and I'm sort of in that transition, beginning to be in that transition from early career to mid-career. I'm not there yet, but I see it kind of coming down the pike. I really think about my work as being about the efficacy, appropriateness, and availability of survivor-centered voluntary services. So how do we promote, develop, and provide access to, an equitable access to, the work that's being done in the service sector?
Absolutely. So a few things that you mentioned. One, can you talk a bit about what is, you definitely gave some salient examples, but like economic justice work. And so speaking to like what that is specifically, and talk a bit more about why you see that connection as being so valuable and important.
So I think economic justice work looks really different for different people. So for me, as somebody who has kind of a clinical background, is just personally kind of an introvert who has liked sitting in my office in my spare bedroom and, you know, writing and Zooming occasionally over this last year, it's looked like really intensive one-on-one economic focused on economic sustainability. So whether that is identifying places where economic abuse is occurring in a relationship or has occurred in the past and working to rectify some of those violations, So for me, that looked like things like doing a lot of credit repair work, spending a lot of time, you know, with like three different colors of highlighters, looking through people's credit reports with them, and figuring out where we could challenge things and where sometimes the best choice is just to say, you know, what's going to drop off. Whatever the right avenue is to open up future opportunities, both for, you know, access just to funds, but also things like jobs and housing that are so linked at this point to credit, in sort of the structures and systems that we have. For other people, that looks like actually challenging those structures and systems, which is so important as well. And you know, whether that has to do with wage gaps between women, people of color, based on employment as well as our discrimination. Looking at access issues, who has access to economic resources? How can we address those gaps in access? And then all of those things relate back to who gets to make choices about their life and ultimately safety. From intimate partner violence and safety more broadly is about having the tools and resources to make independent decisions about your own life. And so economic justice work is related to specifically addressing where economic tools and economic power has been used as part of coercive control, as a tool for perpetuating physical and emotional violence, but also sort of addressing and intersecting where those things are just part of what perpetuates disempowerment more broadly in society. And so initially in my work as an advocate, that was really focused on things like addressing income and addressing access to resources, helping survivors, walking with survivors through the process of dealing with different systems. As I have focused now as an academic, as a researcher, one of the places that comes up for me a lot is in my work around students and around campus violence. I so respected the work that was being done. And this is when I was sort of initially in my PhD program, which began in 2011. The same year that the first White House Obama-era letters and guidance came out around Title IX. And so there was a huge swell of interest in and attention to, further attention to, there's already work being done. It got highlighted around things like bystander intervention, around things like college survivor experiences. But one of the things that I think is natural, because these are the places where researchers are, is it was really focused at more elite universities. And it identified students as being predominantly privileged 18 to 24-year-olds. Many of those students were white. Most of these students were cisgendered female. They had the access. And raising the issue was really important. As someone who previously had done economic justice work in the field in community colleges, I had seen how being a survivor, and in particular in that situation, being a survivor of intimate partner violence, as well as being a survivor of sexual violence. And I think sometimes in college work, we center and focus on sexual violence in a way that maybe misses the fact that a lot of that is intimate partner violence. And that survivors of intimate partner violence may have some other unique needs. But all of that together really helped me think about the campus advocacy work that I'm currently doing, along with the dynamic and fabulous Lisa Wood, and the thoughts that I've been writing about and thinking about more related to academic abuse and school sabotage are forms of economic justice work, especially for folks for whom that access to higher education maybe isn't as assumed, isn't as easily, isn't built in the same way that it might be for a lot of potential, you know, 18 to 24 year old traditional students at more elite institutions. And so that's one of the ways that my thinking about what economic justice is has kind of evolved and expanded to include academic justice and access to academic supports for survivors, both in elite, fabulous institutions that are doing great work and in institutions that maybe don't have that level of resourcing or assumed capacity. And how do we do that as well? So
it's the never-ending journey.
When you get researchers in the room and say, let's tell us about things, you're going to get things. Is A going to be connected to B? No. I'm better at it now, but it used to be that anytime I wrote a manuscript,
sure,
I would leave the introduction and the thesis out. I would write the whole thing. And by the time I got to the end, I'm like, and here's the, I read the thesis and the conclusion is actually what should go at the top. And then I rewrite it. And that was my system for a really long time. And it worked really well. I'm actually to the point now where I often actually know what the thesis is and like, can write it in the correct order. But that took until like midway through the tenure track.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Figure out what I'm saying by the end and then go
by the end of it. I like that method though. I think that's it's affirming that, it's okay to not always go in with the exact
answer. It emerges and sometimes you know it, but you're not ready to say it as clearly as you are by the end.
Yeah. Absolutely. One of the things that you mentioned, and I just want to clarify, you said school sabotage. Can you explain a bit what that means or what that means in your work?
School sabotage is a term that we used in practice at Roe. To my knowledge, I was the first person to actually write a paper about it using that term. That doesn't mean that the idea hasn't been there more broadly. Some people also might talk about it in terms of like calling it academic abuse or educational sabotage. Just the idea that a partner who uses power and control in relationships, along with the sort of other tactics that we think about on the power and control wheel, if their partner, the survivor, is a student, that's one of the places where there might be sort of explicit abusive tactics occurring. So in some of my work, what we've done is sort of try to identify what some of those tactics are just to help elucidate the concept. So some of those things that we've heard about either quantitatively or qualitatively in the research that I've done over the last 6 to 8 years are things like partners who destroy textbooks at the beginning of a year, but right after they've been purchased. Partners who disrupt financial aid or spend the financial aid check on things other than what they were intended to be for. In the last year, we've heard a lot about partners disrupting the internet at critical moments. So if you're in that half an hour window when you opened the browser to take your, 30-minute quiz that you can only open the browser for once and your partner pulls out the Wi-Fi. Destroying laptops, similarly. A lot of sort of new versions are things that have come up in interviews that we've done over the last year. But that idea of school being one of the places where you can exert power and control, and where in an abusive or an unhealthy relationship, along with the challenges of being a student, which is hard all on its own, and all of the other life things that are going on, which are in lots of different vectors hard on their own, if you have a partner who is supportive, that can be a huge benefit. As somebody who did a PhD while birthing and caring for 2 children, I can vouch for the fact that having a supportive partner is essential often in doing that work, especially when you're doing it while navigating other life things. Similarly, having a partner who is potentially emotionally manipulative. So things that we've heard about in interviews have been partners who use the time spent at school as sort of evidence that they're not loved. You spend more time on school than you do on me. And sort of that kind of manipulation. Partners, one story, one interview that still sticks to me, it was from my dissertation with community college students, but I still have a very vivid memory of talking to the survivor, and she was describing needing to get a certain grade. She needed to get a C on a geography exam to finish her prereqs that were necessary to get into the professional program at the community college that she wanted to get into. And she knew that getting into that professional program and getting that credential, it was a healthcare credential, was going to be really critical to her being safe from her partner, who was highly abusive and highly manipulative in the long term. And I think her partner knew that that was something that was going to give her more power in the relationship too. And you know, one of the things that we know is that where power is shifting in a relationship is a moment of potential higher stress or violence. So she had this geography exam that she was really stressed about because wasn't her best area, her best subject. And her partner kept her up the entire night before yelling at her about how she was going to fail the test. And that's a form of school sabotage or economic abuse. She got a B after writing, "You're going to fail the test," on the top of the test as like for motivation. Another example of incredible survivor resilience and awesomeness.
Yeah, I really appreciate you giving the anecdote. I think it really highlights and makes it very salient, like exactly what you're talking about. So thank you. I mean, it's incredibly disappointing and, you know, obviously hard to be reminded that those realities exist for a lot of people. But they exist
for our students, too. Yeah, right. It's one of the things that it's such an interesting overlap for me as someone who is in a research intensive position, but I'm a faculty member to students. I'm at an HSI. My students are not the most privileged. Certainly, it's a very different experience than teaching at WashU when I was a graduate student there. But it is such a opportunity to put into practice the work that's being done, because our students are also survivors. And so are often incredibly engaged and interested in what domestic violence service work looks like. They're passionate about it and interested in it. And they've also had the impacts and resonate with sort of the importance of a voluntary and survivor-centered and culturally relevant and appropriate approach. And that's something that is just really lovely about sort of this intersection of doing campus survivor work on campus. Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah, I think that's a really critical point. So what you were saying earlier about the connection between campus data and looking at like the 18-year-old population, right? Kind of like what we see when we're talking about campus sexual violence, or like when we're thinking about advocacy, is like it's the 18-year-old cis white female and that experience. And that leaves out the context of sort of everything else that could be different. I think what you're talking about feels incredibly important, because then on the faculty side of it, we forget that people are those students. Because what we see is, even in the data, that what we're seeing is that experience of someone too. So I say that as like a bit of an affirmation, but also as a space to ask, like, can you speak a bit more about where you see that change needing to happen, or like happening? Because it sounds like what you're talking about, like that's the work that you're in. So yeah. So what do you see as that next step to trying to move away from what has been our standard, really?
I do see it happening, and I see it happening more and more, which is wonderful. I think the thing in that work that I'm most excited about right now is the opportunity that our current context is providing to expand campus-based advocacy. So there have been, historically, many campuses have had crisis hotlines, have had maybe women's centers or other resources. What we're seeing more and more are really models that look a lot like community-based domestic violence and sexual assault service providers. The sort of dual-affiliated programs that have advocates and counselors and maybe have a housing program component as a piece of it, that are really, the model that we see across the country in the community being replicated on campus, but with some adaptations. And I will again highlight the work that I've done with Lila Wood on campus-based advocacy that we're sort of finishing up this summer. We've been 3 years working on 5 different campuses here in Texas, looking at those models and then looking at the impacts of campus-based advocacy from students. And we were really thoughtful and focused on not just capturing the data from UT Austin, which is the big state flagship, maybe has a few more resources, but also has a very diverse student body, but also at 4 other institutions, all of whom are HSIs, 2 of whom are on the border, two of which are in very urban centers and have large commuter student populations. And just using the example of my institution, our average student age is almost 30. The needs of a 30-year-old who is experiencing intimate partner violence or sexual violence, regardless of who that perpetrator is or where it's occurring, are going to be very different than an 18-year-old who's living on campus. It doesn't mean that there won't be some similar things. So the things, you know, the really interesting, innovative, critical things that we're seeing is stuff like programs who keep housing availability on campus, not even necessarily just for on-campus students, but programs who can overnight get you into a dorm room that is safe and away from your partner for a period of time. Programs that are really replicating not only the sort of the advocacy and the supportive services that are so critical, but the access to resources. So whether that's food pantries or managing all sorts of the financial intricacies of being involved in a university system, or access to healthcare. Our partner in the Rio Grande Valley is opening a SANE program within their campus-based advocacy program, along with access to housing and food. That's a full-service community service agency being run actually by a philosophy professor who is an incredible resource to her students and the community. We've had these conversations now with programs, at this point I can say across the country, who have accessed some of the work we've done trying to disseminate our findings to providers. So we developed, along with the manuscripts that you do as an academic, a toolkit of sort of really what we tried to make as concrete as possible in terms of evaluation resources and adaptation resources and a logic model. To say, like, the program thoughts are, if you do these things, then this should happen, and then this should happen, which is a simple but incredibly challenging thing at the same time to do and to articulate clearly, especially for programs like advocacy that are so tailored and should be, when they're being done well, so tailored to the specific needs of both the community and the survivor specifically. So that has been, I think, something that with the reinterpretation of Title IX that's occurring and will continue going forward.
Right.
Frankly, with the requirement for supportive services that has the opportunity to be interpreted as providing these sorts of things, if a university system wants to interpret it that way, that could be a really good thing. And in fact, we've seen on several campuses and in our studies that along with a lot of the concerning changes that have been made to interpretation of Title IX recently, the requirement for supportive services as a piece of that intervention could be implemented in really survivor-centered and effective ways if we can get the voices of advocates to the table. If we can collaborate and build the understanding of what that is in a way that says it's things like tailored advocacy and survivor-centered services, and recognizing that it's the choice of the survivor to engage or not engage in other processes as they would see fit. So that's a piece of what I'm excited about going forward and seeing really blossom and expand, and also moving to community colleges. These models getting beyond the highly resourced institutions, whether that's through consortiums whether that's through partnerships between institutions. So again, in the Rio Grande Valley, you know, the work that UTRGV, the University of Texas Rio Grande Valley campus program is doing now is extending to South Texas College in their community college system. And they are serving as the sort of support folks who can navigate some of the things that those institutions don't have the same level of structure or support for doing. And collaborate like that is just really exciting.
Yeah. Like, I think the community college work is really kind of that next level. And I'm happy to know and see and hear like more folks paying attention, because there's so much to be done. I mean, for that reason, like, again, going back to like the data that we've been collecting, and I very much am generalizing. I know that that's not true across the board, but like,
I mean, it's general. Yeah.
It's like, it's not community colleges. It's not commuter students. It's not anything but that sort of standard of what we expect a survivor to look like and be like.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's really understandable why it would look like, you know, we can trace that back way back as to why it looks like that right now. We also know better. And one of the opportunities we have as social work scholars in particular is to know better.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, 47% of American college students are in community college campuses. Your average undergraduate is not attending a four-year institution for the first
time. It's a huge number. That's a factoid to that.
And I'm not saying that college is the right choice for everybody, but it is for a lot of people. And opening up that access and making sure that it's not disrupted by things like interpersonal violence or other experiences of trauma is, going back to what we were talking about at the beginning, part of economic justice work. It's part of equity. So it's an exciting development in the work to do that. And also, along with the work being done in the Rio Grande Valley, New Hampshire, the work being done at the University of New Hampshire, Sharon Potter's group, and we're really pioneering that as well.
Yeah. It makes me think about what you said too about sort of liking advocates as researchers and the reasoning for that, of like the understanding and the context of what it's like to be in the service provision or on the advocacy side of things. It helps in terms of that kind of that awareness that you're talking about, and the ability to ask different and better questions. And to know better, you know, like, so can you speak a bit about, I know you've mentioned the work you're doing with Leela, and like hard
to refer to me about as, her. I will talk about her this night. We did a webinar together Monday, I guess it was, on advocacy for preventionists, sort of college related advocacy stuff. And she introduced me as her research life partner, I think.
Oh,
that was adorable. And she's like, I can't believe I said that out loud. And it was the best thing ever. So she's my research life partner.
Oh, that's amazing. Lucky for the both of you. That's so beautiful.
I don't know how I got so lucky. Tanya, I think that's the reason I got so lucky. Actually, she introduced us in a SWER. We were both presenting in the same session at SWER. And she's like, you just need to talk. And we haven't stopped talking for years and years.
That's the best.
Anyway, you're asking me about Leela, and I'm happy to do it.
Oh, well, just I was going to have you or ask for you to about your current work. What are you like? Yeah. And so you can spoke a bit about some of the work that you and Leela have been doing, but yeah, just maybe more specifically, just what do you currently have going on?
Sure. And a lot of it is work I'm doing with Leela, both in terms of the campus advocacy work and it's some other things. So we're wrapping up our campus advocacy project, which I've done with Dr. Wood along with Dr. Cynthia Jones from UTRGV. And it's been now the last 3 years. developing a model of campus-based advocacy based on the 7 programs we were studying, along with developing a longitudinal data set of survivor outcomes for survivors who used campus-based advocacy work. So the baseline is totally done. We have something like 6 waves of data that should be wrapped up by the fall. And we'll be disseminating both sort of manuscript-y kinds of things, as well as a really strong emphasis in this project on tools that advocates and campuses can use. Either those that are thinking about starting programs, and you know, we anticipate there being funding to start these programs in the next few years. So we're really excited about being able to get that out for advocates who want to approach their universities, or advocates within their universities who want to expand the work they're doing related to the development of programs, what a sort of model that's done with fidelity to the basic tenets of campus advocacy looks like, and evaluation of that work. As well as some more advocate-specific trainings around academic safety planning. How do you develop academic accommodations? What, you know, creative strategies have we heard advocates talking about that you might be able to employ on your own campus? So that dissemination piece is a really big part of, especially what we're doing this summer and into the fall, which is really exciting. And then at the end, the quantitative longitudinal data set will be complete, and we'll have that kind of data to share as well in terms of well-being outcomes, academic outcomes, and sort of mental health and physical health outcomes of engaging in advocacy as a student. So that's really exciting. We're also just starting on a project that we're co-leading, Dr. Wood and I, through with the support of the Texas Council on Family Violence and the Health and Human Services Commission, which is our sort of state level social service funder and agent, state agency, looking at the efficacy of non-residential services provided by the voluntary service sector, both to help develop some easy to use, sort of friendly to advocates, but still culturally relevant and appropriate evaluation tools that might be able to be used statewide, and then also to look at places where we can dig into state policy and sort of state regulations to expand what might be able to be funded or to double down on structures that are working for funding the core needs of survivors who are not in residential services. And so that is both looking at what's being done by sort of our traditional family violence service agencies, but also by culturally specific agencies or other groups that might not currently be sort of have easy access to state funding. How can we open up some of those pots of money to groups that are doing really important survivor-centered work, but maybe haven't had the same traditional access to those pots of monies previously? So that's a really exciting opportunity that we're getting started over the summer on doing a qualitative piece, and that will be then followed by some measure development and psychometrics and cognitive interviewing, and then a quantitative piece. So it's got both the really cool sort of advocacy and service sector engagement, and also a little bit of nerdiness engaged in it.
Awesome.
Some fun with psychometrics. So I'm excited.
I
am playing a minor role in the Safe Transitions study that Bethany Backus is creating out of University of Central Florida. So Leela and I are sort of the West team on that. Coordinating Texas is one of the 5 states where the transitional housing programs are going to be located for that longitudinal outcomes evaluation. And we're also looking at ways to expand that to looking at children and teens living in transitional housing as well, and the impacts of that service model for those really important residents in transitional housing programs for survivors. And then the other thing that I've gotten to do, and this has been with my colleagues at UT Arlington, and in particular with some of my colleagues who do a lot of work on pedagogy and education, has been thinking about how we teach social workers about intimate partner violence. So we have spent the last couple of years both developing and implementing, and then sort of evaluating and studying, where we're doing a couple of different interprofessional education and simulation-based strategies for helping our social work students to gain the really specific sort of assessment and safety planning skills that they need to be certainly effective advocates, but also effective in social work more broadly, regardless of what particular sector you're going into. Having at least the sort of the capacity to do almost an expert level sort of brief safety planning intervention and effective referral to specialists, family violence services, but also helping other professional students, nursing students, education students, criminal justice, psychology, and the students who are working in our student affairs office, giving them exposure to what kind of services are out there and the need for intimate partner violence services. And so we've been doing a lot of work on how do we do that in a way that gets both our social work students the specific knowledge they need and exposes emerging professionals more broadly to the fact that they're going to come into contact with.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's just been a really fun thing to do and implementing all of that in our own courses. So we're sort of like we're teaching and we're lucky to have a course on intimate partner violence specifically in our master's curriculum. And we have a very, very large master's program. So, you know, we have like 5 sections going at any time. So a lot of us come in and out of teaching it and work together to, you know, anytime somebody has a fun idea, we all try to implement it and see how it goes. And then come back.
Right.
Figure out what happens from there.
That's nice. I mean, it's nice to have that kind of support and the ability to kind of brainstorm in that way, right? To like connect with other people about it. I'm going to give you the last question that I usually like to ask everybody. If you had unrestricted money that someone was just like, you can do what you want with it, what would you want to see happen with that?
If I'm going to grant that I could write the RFP for myself.
Yeah.
That actually was one of my qualifying same questions.
Really?
Right, literally. And obviously what I would say now is quite different because I've kind of done that process already. I think if I had unrestricted research funds, and could do whatever I want, the first thing I would need to do is ask Leela Wood what she wants to do. Because one of my favorite things about research is getting to work with her and the fact that we have very similar perspectives in a lot of ways, but also very, like, we talk about it in different ways and we complement each other really well. But I think what I would do is work with agencies across the country and paid for a really robust shelter diversion program that I would then study. So looking at ways that we can move people, sort of skipping the emergency shelter step in services, from an initial engagement to a more stable housing model that still has access to intensive advocacy and other resources and employment support and mental health support and healthcare support. But not necessarily with that needing to have a communal living emergency shelter experience in the middle. And comparing that then to outcomes from high quality shelter programs. And looking at how we could sort of move in that direction.
Right. Why does that feel like the important or an important step for the field?
So a piece of it is what we've seen over the last year with COVID, which is that communal and something that we've known as advocates and survivors for a long time, which is communal living has a lot of downsides, especially for people who are dealing with all kinds of complex trauma needs with their kids in a small area. It's really hard. It's an incredibly important service. So you can't get rid of it without something else there. Being able to provide immediate safety is a signature service of the field. It is life-saving. It is an open door, the front entry to all kinds of other things. It also can be too much sometimes. And if we think about trauma and we think about mental health and we think about throwing people with all kinds of different diversities into a small space, living together in the hardest moment of everybody's life, and then ask a workforce to work there in their home at the same time, it's a whole lot to ask. And we ask it be done for everybody's safety. But if there's a way to do it that is more sustainable, both for survivors and for the people working with survivors, I think we have an opportunity to continue to shift the needle, to continue to move towards a safer set of services, to build an environment where more people feel welcomed and included, where more people are able to sustain in services over time, and where more people are ultimately safe or safer. One of the things that I've had the chance to do that we did in the past with the Texas Council on Family Violence was look at survivors who weren't currently engaged in services and ask why. And there are a whole bunch of reasons, some of which are very specific and some of which are related to structural inequities and experience of discrimination, and some of which boil down to, I did and it was really hard. And one of the ways that we can address that is by thinking about other front doors into service and other ways of making immediate safety accessible and available. Similarly, I think looking at mobile advocacy and looking at virtual services.
Sure.
Yeah. Has a critical piece. Not everybody needs housing. For people who need it, it's an immediate and overwhelming need. But for a lot of people, that's not the central focus. And where those unique, complexities can be addressed in ways that are lower barrier, again, bring more people in and help people stay in. And ultimately, we know that the outcomes are best for people who get in and stay in.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely.
Also, I just want to get that amount of money to all those agencies.
All right. I mean,
like, any time a city can be like, let's throw $100,000 at an agency and then see what we do. We're going to do good things.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's going to be a good thing to do. Yeah. Absolutely.
You know, I believe even if nothing else works, we got these resources to agencies.
Absolutely.
That's a project for me. So, I mean, you know, it's a way of making myself feel better for asking people to work with me. I don't want to bother people. I don't know where it comes from, somewhere far back in my world.
Right.
My assumption is I'm always bothering people and I shouldn't.
Yeah.
Which is not to say that Lily doesn't have any assumption, but she's much more comfortable being like, I have something to help people with. I will later read and I'll just talk.
Yeah.
Why don't we work well together?
She balances that out.
She's willing to just like try stuff, whereas I am much more hesitant to possibly step on someone's toes or get in the way.
Sure.
And make the assumption that I am stepping on people's toes or getting in the way. So when I can say like, I have $10,000 for you to an agency, it's much, much
easier. That feels way better.
I'd initial email to the executive director, even in places where, you know, I've worked with them a lot and they ask a lot of me. And like, I know they, you know, like we have this agreement, it works. But
yeah.
It's hard.
Yeah. Absolutely. I understand. I get that. Well, I wish you nothing but $10,000 to give to the agencies you work with.
Thank you. That's the dream. Now, here is totally just, I have nothing to do with it, but talking about that and talking about important work that's happened in the last year. If you haven't interviewed Dr. Wood yet, or if you're going to at some point in the future ever again, the work that she has done expanding access to emergency mental health services to advocates in the last year is really both an incredible use of power as a researcher to create something that not only has benefits for sort of knowledge, but has benefit for people doing, for people. And is a fabulous example of a strategy to address the incredible occupational stress that advocates are under And I had nothing to do with it. So I'd be called an out completely. I'm just fangirling it. It's amazing.
That's perfect. No, that's really helpful. I have talked to her before, but she was one of the first interviews I ever did. And it was actually in person. So it's like, we could do another one now. And I would love to hear her talk more about that.
You know, one of the things that can get lost is that ultimately the work is supposed to have impact and it's one of the things that's exciting about being in this field.
Absolutely.
There is so much more work that needs to get done than there are people doing it. There's room for everyone. There's like the level of, I don't know, competitiveness that there could be is only there if you choose to sort of put it in your own head. And everybody can choose to put it in their own head sometimes because that's whatever. But the truth is, we need everyone's work.
Absolutely.
The work that everyone's doing really quickly can filter up to the top of the field. There's so much less bureaucracy. There are so many fewer steps between the people doing the work and the people paying them, the people paying them at their agencies and the people funding that work. It's such a really lean system in a lot of ways. That our work can have, comparatively to other forms of social service, and certainly to research in general, really quick and substantial impact in practice, if that's where sort of you want to focus your dissemination and sort of the questions that you're asking on things that are sort of practice focused. And that's, you know, why I love doing really practice and field specific work. Is it really does trickle really quickly. It rushes.
Yeah.
The use.
Yeah, absolutely. The impact can be pretty meaningful in those spaces for sure. Well, I really appreciate you making time and being willing to talk with me and share your work and your perspective. And I hope that our paths cross at that point.
And if it's at a conference, I'm hoping it will be with Lila so we can.
Exactly. That would be wonderful.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Coffee Chats with Researchers. You can always find more of these coffee chats on our website, which is vawconsortium.rutgers.edu. And of course, you can always reach out to us via social media or via email. We are always happy to hear from you with your thoughts, your questions, your feedback, or just generally to give us a hello. As always, stay curious, ask questions, drink coffee, and we will see you for our next episode of Coffee Chats with Researchers.